This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? By Jesse Baring. Read for you by the author.
An Invitation to Impropriety. For as long as I can remember, I've been sincerely curious, and vocally so, about certain inappropriate matters. My most earnest questions, I've noticed, tend to cause other people to back away from me very slowly. You might say I'm a little too analytical for my own good. "Isn't it unusual?" I asked the absolutely horrified girl sitting next to me in my sixth grade homeroom class one memorable day. "That my penis, when erect, is shaped more like a scimitar than it is a dagger." "Certainly that must mean I'm deformed," I confided, whispering in her ear. "Since obviously to penetrate a female like you properly, a penis must go straight into a vagina, not approach it from a 45-degree angle as mine stands." Over time, I learned to bite my tongue, but a salacious mind, once stirred, seldom gets rest. As I very slowly gained some much-needed social skills, I also found myself gravitating increasingly toward the world of science, a world in which nothing was sacred, no question too absurd or off-limits, at least for the sake of discussion, if not necessarily ethical fodder for the laboratory, and one in which I discovered other like-minded souls who didn't look at me as though I had three heads when I asked whether, say, people who prefer to be the recipient in anal intercourse might have a differently configured anal-genital internal anatomy than those who find it intensely unpleasant. I still don't know the answer to that question, by the way. Speaking of which, I should probably also add, since it will become obvious enough by my disproportionate focus on male genitalia, that there was something very important to me that was denied full expression in my earlier years, and that undoubtedly shaped my view of the world. I was gay. Very, very gay, in fact. I confirmed this incontrovertible truth through numerous experiments in my adolescence, including groping and kissing unwitting girlfriends, who, in spite of their objective good looks and wonderful personalities, were as arousing to me as a perfume slab of ham with sparkling white teeth. This wasn't just the virginal jitters, I can assure you, but girls seemed to make my penis positively catatonic, while even from afar, boys made it stand at that oddly 45-degree angle I mentioned before. So, let me start by offering a full disclosure. My perspective is that of a godless, gay, psychological scientist with a penchant for far-flung evolutionary theories. Still, although I certainly don't try to hide my own personal convictions, I'm an impolitic person. All I ask is that you try to suspend judgment until after you've heard at least a handful of essays. Just lean back, unbutton your pants, and by all means get comfortable with yourself. Maybe relax with a glass of Chardonnay. And think. I hope to make that last part easy for you. I want you to enjoy learning about your wildly ejaculating penises, your dribbling vulvae, and your own fears, biases, fetishes, and desires. Despite our differences, and there are certainly many in this world, there's one thing we all have in common. We're human. I'm not interested in sensationalism for its own sake, but many of the questions that appeal to me most are, by definition, rather sensational. If you look at them closely enough, however, you'll notice how often the most titillating topics are uniquely able to raise deeper philosophical questions and to bring much more substantial issues to the surface. For instance, in reading about zoophiles, you may find yourself, as I did, questioning your own knee-jerk, moralistic sexual repulsions. A look at the evolution of pubic hair or acne unexpectedly reveals our close genetic relationship with other apes. Masturbation fantasies reveal what makes us unique in the animal kingdom, and foot fetishists expose how our adult turn-ons are permanently calibrated by often innocent childhood experiences. I do try to be a good scientist first and foremost, whether I'm investigating female ejaculation, six-month-old infants unexpectedly sprouting pubic hair, or the psychology of women curiously entranced by gay men. Since many of these essays were published originally in some form in my columns at Scientific American and Slate magazines, and therefore survey only the most interesting dimensions of any given topic, I'm certainly not able to cover every aspect and contrary viewpoint surrounding every issue. I encourage you, however, to explore further about the subjects that leave you wanting more. So please join me in impropriety. Let's not subscribe to the "some things are better left unsaid" school of life. How very boring that must be. I invite you to follow along with me on a journey of scientific discovery. But do watch your step. It's a slippery one. And note that although the mood is for the most part light, it won't be all fun and games. Some of the essays I've included in this anthology are actually rather sobering, including a really close look at the mindset of a suicidal person. I wrote that particular piece in response to the alarming rash of gay teen suicides in recent years. And that was an essay that resonated, unfortunately so, with many readers, some of whom courageously shared their personal stories with me after stumbling upon it. There are 8 sections in this volume, each one representing a general theme or subject area and sampling the astounding oddities of simply being human. The first of these sections, Darwinizing What Dangles, includes everything you didn't know you always wanted to know about male reproductive anatomy. In part 2, Bountiful Bodies, we'll examine how we may be designed by Mother Nature to consume each other's flesh, why we're the only ape that suffers from acne, and many other little-known things about seemingly banal body parts. Next, in part 3, Minds in the Gutter, we'll explore some very dirty brain science, pushing our common sense into a few uncomfortable corners in the process. This prepares us for part 4, Strange Bedfellows, where we'll take a critical, non-judgmental look at some of the more intriguing sexual paraphilias, fetishes, and conditions, exploring their developmental origins, theories, and debates regarding clinical diagnoses. If you think having sex with animals is inherently wrong, or that sexuality starts in adolescence with the first flush of hormones, you may come away from this section with an unexpected change of mind. In Ladies' Night, Part 5, we'll turn our attention specifically to the minds and bodies of women. Just note that I'm a gay man looking onto these minds and bodies, so my take is a bit different from most. Speaking of which, and I'm not sure what Nietzsche would have to say about the content of the following section, in Part 6, The Gayer Science, There's Something Queer Here, we'll then focus on some of the latest and most provocative studies on homosexuality. In Part 7, For the Bible Tells Me So, we'll examine how religion stems from our evolved psychology and how our standard burial practices aren't doing ourselves or the planet any favors. And finally, in the last section of the book, Into the Deep Existential Lab Work, we'll dig into some weighty, soul-wrenching questions about suicide, the meaning of life, and the evolution of joy and happiness. Excited? I hope so. And what better place for us to start than by asking why in the world testicles hang like that? And why does it hurt so much to get kicked there? Part 1. Darwinizing What Dangles. How are they hanging? This is why they are. A few years ago, the evolutionary psychologist Gordon Gallup, who we'll meet again, along with his colleagues Mary Finn and Becky Samis, set out to explain the natural origins of the only human male body part arguably less attractive than the penis, the testicles. In many respects, their so-called activation hypothesis elaborates on what many of us already know about descended scrotal testicles. They serve as a sort of cold storage and production unit for sperm, which keep best at a temperature slightly lower than the norm for the rest of our bodies. But the activation hypothesis goes much further than this fun fact. It turns out that human testicles display some rather elaborate yet subtle temperature regulating features that have gone largely unnoticed by doctors, researchers, and laymen alike. The main tenet of the activation hypothesis is that the heat of a woman's vagina radically jumpstarts sperm that have been hibernating in the cool, airy scrotal sac. This heat aids conception. Yet it explains many other things too, including why one testicle is usually slightly lower than the other, why the skin of the scrotum sometimes becomes rugose, prune-like and as wrinkled as an elephant's elbow, why the testicles retract during sexual arousal, and even why testicular injuries, compared with other types of bodily assaults, are so excruciatingly painful. To help us all get on the same page, consider an alternate reality, one in which ovaries, like testicles, descend during embryological development and emerge outside the female body cavity in a thin, unprotected sac. After you've wiped that image from your mind's eye, note that the dangling gonads of many male animals, including humans, are no less puzzling. After all, why in all of evolution would nature have designed a body part with such obviously enormous reproductive importance to hang outside the body, so defenseless and vulnerable? We tend to become accustomed to our body parts, and it often fails to occur to us to even ask why they are the way they are. Some of the biggest evolutionary mysteries are also the most mundane aspects of our lives. So the first big question is why so many mammalian species evolved hanging scrotal testicles to begin with. The male gonads in some phylogenetic lineages went in completely different directions, evolutionarily speaking. For example, modern elephant testicles are deeply embedded in the body cavity, a trait referred to as testacond. Whereas other mammals, such as seals, have descended testicles but are without scrota, with the gonad simply being subcutaneous. Gallup and his colleagues jogged through several possible theories of our species' testicular evolution by descent. One of the more fanciful accounts, and one ultimately discarded by the researchers, is that scrotal testicles evolved in the same spirit as peacock feathers. That is to say, given the enormous disadvantage of having your entire genetic potential contained in a thin satchel of unprotected, delicate flesh, and swinging several millimeters away from the rest of your body, perhaps scrotal testicles evolved as a sort of ornamental display communicating the genetic quality of the male. In evolutionary biology, this type of adaptationist account appeals to the handicapping principle. The theoretical gist of the handicapping principle is that if the organism can thrive and survive while still being hobbled by a costly maladaptive trait, such as elaborate, cumbersome plumage, or in this case, vulnerably drooping gonads, then it must have some high-quality genes and be a valuable mate. But the handicapping hypothesis doesn't quite fit the case of descended scrotal testicles, explain the authors, because if it were true, then we would expect to see these body parts becoming increasingly elaborate and dangly over the course of evolution. Not to mention, women should display a preference for males toting around the most ostentatious scrotal baggage. With the possible exception of colored scrota among a few species of primates, writes Gallup, there is little evidence that this has been the case. I'm not aware of any studies on intraspecies individual variation in scrotal design, but I'm nonetheless willing to speculate that most human males have rather bland, run-of-the-mill scrota. Anything deviating from this, particularly a set of unusually pendulous testicles suspended in knee-length scrota, is probably more likely to have a woman dry-heaving, screaming, or staring in confusion rather than serving as an aphrodisiac. Again, a more likely explanation for scrotal descent, and one that has been around for some time, is that sperm production and storage are maximized at cooler temperatures. Not only is the skin of the scrotal sac thin to promote heat dissipation, the authors write, the arteries that supply blood to the scrotum are positioned adjacent to the veins taking blood away from the scrotum and function as an additional cooling-heating exchange mechanism. As a consequence of these adaptations, average scrotal temperatures in humans are generally 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius lower than body temperature, which is 37 degrees Celsius. And spermatogenesis is most efficient at 34 degrees Celsius. Sperm are extraordinarily sensitive to even minor fluctuations in climate. When the ambient temperature rises to body levels, there is a momentary increase in sperm motility. They become more lively, but only for a period of time before fizzing out. To be more exact, sperm thrive at body temperature for 50 minutes to 4 hours, the average length of time it takes for them to journey through the female reproductive tract and fertilize the egg. But once the spermatic atmosphere rises much above 37 degrees Celsius, the chances for a successful insemination consequently plummet. Any viable sperm become the equivalent of burned toast. So in other words, except during sex, when it's adapted for sperm to be hyperactive, sperm are stored and produced most efficiently in the cool, breezy surroundings of the relaxed scrotal sac. One doesn't want his scrotum to be too cold, however, since nature has calibrated these temperature points at precisely defined optimal levels. Fortunately, human scrota don't just hang there holding our testicles and brewing our sperm. They also actively employ some interesting thermoregulatory tactics to protect and promote males' genetic interests. Actively should be placed in scare quotes, of course, because although it would be rather odd to ascribe consciousness to human scrota, testicles do respond unintentionally to the reflexive actions of the cremasteric muscle. This muscle serves to retract the testicles so they are drawn up closer to the body when it gets cold. Just think cold shower, and also to relax them when it gets too hot. This up-and-down action happens on a moment-to-moment basis. Thus, male bodies continually optimize the gonadal climate for spermatogenesis and sperm storage. It's also why it's generally inadvisable for men to wear tight-fitting jeans or especially snug, tighty-whities. Under these restrictive conditions, the testicles are shoved up against the body and artificially warmed so that the cremasteric muscle cannot do its job properly. Another reason not to wear these things is that it's no longer 1988. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Dr. Baring, how do you account for the fact that testicles are rarely perfectly symmetrical in their positioning within the same scrotum? In fact, the temperature regulating function governed by the cremasteric muscle can account even for the most lopsided one testicle above the other waffling asymmetries in testes positioning. According to a 2009 report in Medical Hypotheses by the anatomist Stanley Lobo and his colleagues, each testicle continuously migrates in its own orbit as a way of maximizing the available scrotal surface that is subjected to heat dissipation and cooling. Like ambient heat generated by individual solar panels, when it comes to spermatic temperatures, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. With a keen enough eye, presumably one could master the art of reading testicle alignment, using the scrotum as a makeshift room thermometer. But that's just me speculating. From an evolutionary perspective, the design of male genitalia only makes sense to the extent that it adaptively complements the female anatomy, which I realize I should really go into more, but there are only so many hours in a day. By contrast to males, unless a woman is engaging in strenuous exercise, the female reproductive tract is maintained continuously at standard body temperature. This is the crux of Gallup's activation hypothesis. The rise in temperature surrounding sperm, as occasioned by ejaculation into the vagina, activates sperm, temporarily making them frenetic and therefore enabling them to acquire the necessary oomph to penetrate the cervix and reach the fallopian tubes. In our view, write the authors, descended scrotal testicles evolved to both capitalize on this copulation insemination contingent temperature enhancement and function to prevent premature activation of sperm by keeping testicular temperatures below the critical values set by body temperatures. One of the things you may have noticed in your own genitalia, or those of someone you're especially close to, is that in contrast to the slackened scrotal skin accompanying flaccid, non-aroused states, penile erections are usually accompanied by a telltale retraction of the testicles closer to the body. This is the sort of thing easiest to demonstrate using visual illustrations, and a quick Google image search should provide ample examples. Just choose your own search terms and disable safe search, though if you're out in public right now, you may want to save this as homework for later. According to Gallup and his co-authors, there is another smart scrotal adaptation. Not only does the cremasteric reflex serve to raise testicular temperature, thus mobilizing sperm for pending ejaculation into the vagina, but, added bonus, it also offers protection against possible damage to two loose testicles resulting from vigorous thrusting during intercourse. There are many other ancillary hypotheses connected to the activation hypothesis as well. For example, the authors ponder whether humans' well-developed preference, and one rather unique in the animal kingdom, for nighttime sex can be at least partially explained by temperature-sensitive testicles. Although the authors note the many additional benefits of nocturnal copulation, such as accommodating clandestine sex or minimizing the threat of predation, this preference may also reflect a circadian adaptation related to descended scrota. Given that our species evolved originally in equatorial regions, where daytime temperatures often soared above body temperature, optimal testicular adjustments would be difficult to maintain in such excessive heat. In contrast, ambient temperatures during the evening and at night fall below body temperature, returning to ideal thermoregulatory conditions for the testes. Additionally, after nighttime sex, the female partner is likely to sleep, thus remaining in a stationary, often supine position that also maximizes the odds of fertilization. Although the activation hypothesis helps us to better understand the functional, if quirky, architecture of the human male gonads, it may still seem odd to you that nature would have invested so heavily in such a precipitously placed genetic bank. After all, we're still left with the curious fact that these precious gametes are literally hanging in the balance in a completely unprotected vessel. Gallup and his co-authors weigh in on this too. Any account of descended scrotal testicles, they write, must also address the enormous potential cost of having the testicles located outside the body cavity, where they are left virtually unprotected and especially vulnerable to insult and damage. To be consistent with evolutionary theory, the potential cost of scrotal testicles would have to be offset not only by compensating benefits, such as sperm activation upon insemination, but one would also expect to find corresponding adaptations that function to minimize or negate these costs. Enter pain, not just any pain, but the unusually acute, excruciating pain accompanying testicular injury. Most males have some horrific stories to tell on this score, whether it be a soccer ball to the groin or the flailing foot of a sibling. But all of us men have something in common. We've all become extraordinarily hypervigilant against threats to the welfare of our scrotal testicles. According to the authors, the fact that males are so squeamish and sensitive regarding this particular body part can again be understood in the context of evolutionary biology. If you're male, the reason you probably wince more when you hear the word squash or rupture paired with testicle than you do with, say, arm or nose, is that testicles are disproportionately more vital to your reproductive success than these other body parts. I, for one, had to pause to cover myself even typing those words together. It's not that those other body parts aren't adaptively important or that it doesn't hurt when they're injured. Rather, it's a question of the degree of pain. Variation in pain sensitivity across different bodily regions, according to this view, reflects the vulnerability and importance that different adaptations play in your reproductive success. Many children have been born of broken-nosed men, but not a single one has ever been sired by a man with two irreparably damaged testicles. The point is that male ancestors who learned to protect their gonads would have left more descendants. And pain is a pretty good motivator for promoting preemptive defensive action. Or to think about it another way, any male in the ancestral past who was oblivious to or freakishly enjoyed testicular insult would have been quickly weeded out of the gene pool. The wonders of the cremasteric muscle don't end here. It also flexes in response to threatening stimuli, in effect pulling the testicles up closer to the body and out of harm's way. In fact, the authors point out, Japanese physicians have been known to apply a pinprick to the inner thigh of male patients as a surgical prep. If the patient displays no cremasteric reflex, the spinal anesthesia has kicked in, and he's ready to go under the knife. Other evidence suggests that fear and the threat of danger trigger the cremasteric reflex. There are a number of ways to test this at home, if you're so inclined. Just make sure the owner of the fearfully reflexive testicles knows what you're up to before frightening him. So there you have it, an evolutionarily informed account of descended scrotal testicles in humans. Is the whole thing nuts? Don't leave me hanging, folks. Ball's in your court. So close and yet so far away, the contorted history of autofellatio. Long before I knew very much about anything regarding sex, I did what many young males do, which of course is to place an empty paper towel roll over my penis and suck hopefully upon the cardboard end. Okay, perhaps not everyone does this. I was a little confused about the suction principle. And now I'm a bit embarrassed by the story, although it has been a full year since the event and I'm much better informed on the subject of fellatio today. Oh, settle down, I'm only joking. Well, kind of. I did actually attempt this feat, but I was 12 or 13 at the time, which, to give you a clearer sense of my unimpressive carnal knowledge at that age, is also around the time that I submitted to my older sister with great confidence that a blowjob involves using one's lips to blow a cool breeze upon another's anus. So to avoid similar confusion, let us define our terms clearly. Autofellatio, the subject at hand, or rather not at hand at all, is the act of taking one's genitals in one's mouth to derive sexual pleasure. Terminology is important here, because at least one team of psychiatrists writing on this subject distinguishes between autofellatio and self-erematio. In non-solo sex, fellatio sees most of the action in the sucking party, while erematio has more of a thrusting element to it, wherein the other person's mouth serves as a passive penile receptacle. Hence the colorful and rather aggressive-sounding slang for erematio, face-fucking, skull-fucking, and so on. In any event, my paper towel roll act was simply a plan B at that puerile age, a futile way to circumvent the obvious anatomical limitations to oral self-gratification. And by all accounts, I wasn't alone in hatching plan A. Alfred Kinsey and his colleagues reported in Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, in fact, that a considerable portion of the population does record attempts at self-fellation, at least in early adolescence. Sadly, given our species' pesky ribcage and hesitant spine, Kinsey estimated that only 2 or 3 of every 1,000 males are able to achieve this feat. There's the story of the Italian decadent poet Gabrielle D'Annunzio, who is said to have had a bone removed to facilitate the act, or that old Saturday Night Live skit in which Will Ferrell enrolls in a yoga class only to become flexible enough to fellate his own organ. But truth is often stranger than fiction. In 1975, the psychiatrist Frances Millikan and her colleagues described the real case of a very disturbed patient who learned yoga precisely for this reason. Now, you may think that being one of the ultra-bendable of the population is all fun and games. We've all heard those quips about never having to leave the house. But think again. There's a long and unfortunate history of pathologizing this behavior. Psychiatrists have described its practitioners as being sexually maladjusted, stuck in an infantile state of suckling dependency, or even motivated by repressed homosexual desires. Take the case described by the psychiatrists Jesse Kavanagh, Jean Spalding, and Nancy Butts, who wrote in 1977 of a lonely 22-year-old serviceman who'd been fellating himself since the age of 12. He was driven mad by the fact that he could physically incorporate only the glands and wanted to be able to incorporate more. Honestly, it must have been so, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's right on the tip of my tongue, frustrating for this poor soldier. This is the ultimate cock tease. It's being so close yet so far away. Since the days of Freud, psychoanalysts have gone to town on the subject of autofellatio. In a 1971 article by the psychiatrist Frank Orland, we see the typical jargon-filled language used in dissecting the symbolic bases of autofellatio, which is conceptualized as a virtual ring of narcissism. Autofellation, writes Orland, represents a recreation of the early infantile state in which the intrapsychic representatives of external objects are separated from the self-object, with a coexisting parasitic symbiosis with the external object. Through the autofellatio phenomenon, he continues, the ego reestablishes the necessary mastery over the external object, representative as a defense against object loss, and to restore the parasitic fusion with the nipple breast. That, ladies and gentlemen, is unadulterated psychobabble. And I tell you this as a psychologist. Sometimes people are motivated to lick their own genitals because it just feels good. Of course, there are always going to be those, such as the dubious yoga master, who take it a bit too far, and for whom autofellatio contributes to mental illness. The foregoing soldier who couldn't take it far enough got so frustrated by his semi-fulfilled fantasy that when he masturbated the old-fashioned way, he could achieve climax only by imagining himself fellating himself. The very first published psychiatric case of autofellatio, appearing in the American Journal of Psychiatry way back in 1938, was also one of the most outrageous and pathological. The patient was a 33-year-old store clerk who, prior to being referred to the Yale psychiatrists Eugene Kahn and Ernest Lyon, had just completed a 60-day jail sentence for sexual assault. Among his perverse practices, explained the authors, were pedophilia, cunnilingualism, homosexual acts, fellatio, sodomy, and mutual masturbation, exhibitionism, transvestism, fetishism, algolagnia, voyeurism, and peeping. But never mind all those vanilla paraphilias. The man's psychiatrists were especially intrigued by his more unusual habit. He seems a devious wee character, this patient of theirs. The authors describe him as being somewhat effeminate in posture, gait, and mannerisms. He stood only 5'2" tall, somewhat thin and with wide hips, they wrote, with a female pattern of distribution of his pubic hair, and his gag reflex is very sluggish. The patient was the third oldest of 8 children and grew up in a strict religious family, which the physicians felt he rebelled against by egregiously breaching their high moral standards. In recounting to the psychiatrist the origins of his interest in autofellatio, the troubled clerk recalled being invited at the age of 14 by a cripple boy to engage in oral sex with him. The patient, being shy, had refused this offer, but the thought of it simmered, and lacking the courage to approach anyone else, he took matters upon himself. He kept trying night after night, write the authors, managing to bend his back more and more until he finally succeeded in August 1923. Just in case you want to mark the anniversary on your calendar. It turns out he liked it. So much, in fact, that even amid the long litany of perversions he enjoyed, self-erimatio instantly became his favorite autoerotic act. In an odd Pavlov's dog sort of way, the authors even describe how the man's sexual arousal had since then been accompanied by a constricting feeling in the throat. That must be a terribly annoying feeling, I'd imagine, and apparently also one not easily resolved. He has attempted to secure substitute gratification, say the authors, by smoking or by stimulating his pharynx with a banana, vaginal douche, or a broom handle. These have yielded various degrees of satisfaction. And he did apparently get over his adolescent shyness and lack of confidence, too. He particularly enjoyed fellating himself in front of a shocked audience. Since this initial case report by Kahn and Lyon, a handful of others have trickled in over the years, with subsequent investigators attempting to find a set of common personality denominators in those who prefer autofellatio over other forms of sex. In a 1954 article in Psychoanalytic Review, for instance, William Guy and Michael Finn saw a theme beginning to emerge. In all of the clinical descriptions, observe these authors, one finds repeatedly such phrases as sensitive, shy, timid, effeminate, and passive. This is code for queer, I believe, and in fact other writers have more expressly noted the often suppressed homosexual desires in these autofellators. In fact, judging by the scant literature, one of the big psychoanalytic questions yet to be resolved satisfactorily seems to be the extent to which engaging in autofellatio, or perhaps simply the desire to do so, signals a latent erotic attraction to the same sex. I suspect, however, that the overrepresentation of gay men in the antiquated case reports is simply a reflection of the cultural ethos of those times. The most recent psychiatric investigations on autofellatio date to the late 1970s, which is around the time that Freud's particular grip on psychiatry lost its tenuous hold. And the earlier ones to the 1930s. So as a rule, the men described therein faced baseless, moralistic prescriptions against homosexuality. This meant other men's penises were very hard to come by. So it's not terribly surprising that those too frightened or closeted to perform fellatio on another man would develop severe neuroses after indulging in their own penises. A 1946 article from the American Journal of Psychiatry exemplifies this phenomenon. The case involves a 36-year-old, highly intelligent, personable, but virginal staff sergeant, not to be confused with the military man we met earlier, with closeted homosexual desires. According to the official record, he'd first performed autofellatio at age 13, but he became so frightened by this impulse that he resisted ever doing so again. That is, until a month prior to arriving at the psychiatric ward of the hospital. After giving himself head in private, the sergeant became intensely paranoid that the other soldiers somehow knew of his autofellatio and that every little snigger, whisper, or averted glance concerned this transgression. He suffered a nervous breakdown on hearing the word cocksucker floating about so casually and playfully in the military barracks, convinced it was meant just for him. It's a rather sad ending for him, too, because despite his responding well to the doctor's reassurance that he was being overly paranoid, the sergeant was discharged for being no longer adaptable within the military service. The therapists assigned to the case, Major Morris Kessler and Captain George Poucher, reached a rather strange conclusion, one that I have a hunch you might disagree with. Sexual self-sufficiency, they write, either by masturbation or autofellatio, is tantamount to having an affinity for one's own sex. In other words, if you were a fan of manual masturbation in 1946, my heterosexual male friends, you'd have been branded a secret homosexual pervert who likes penises so much that he gives himself handjobs. This would have made autofellatio a devil of a case under the Clinton-era Don't Ask, Don't Tell ban on gays in the military had it arisen then. And seriously, good riddance to those ignorant days of yore. To each his own, quite literally in the case of autofellatio. I know, I didn't even get a chance to talk about autocunnilingus in females. Given the even more serious anatomical hurdles in lacking a protruding reproductive device, such behavior in women may not even be possible. I confess I don't know, and there's no mention of it in the scientific literature. The closest female comparison to autofellatio I stumbled upon is the case of women who suckle from their own breasts, for sexual or other purposes. One therapist writes of an especially self-sufficient female patient who had a habit of doing this. When he asked her why, she merely replied, "I'm hungry." But that's another story for another day. Why is the penis shaped like that? The extended cut. If you've ever had a good long look at the human phallus, whether yours or someone else's, you've probably scratched your head over its peculiar shape. Let's face it, it's not the most intuitively configured appendage in all of evolution. But according to the evolutionary psychologist Gordon Gallup, the human penis is actually an impressive tool in the truest sense of the word, one manufactured by nature over hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution. You may be surprised to discover just how highly specialized a tool it is. Furthermore, you'd be amazed at what its appearance can tell us about the nature of our sexuality. The curious thing about the evolution of the human penis is that for something that differs so obviously in shape and size from that of our closest living relatives, only in the past few years have researchers begun studying its natural history in any detail. The reason for this neglect isn't clear. It's hard to imagine that hard-nosed scientists would be worried about the subject stirring up uncomfortable puritanical sentiments. The issue does have an intrinsic snicker factor, so I realize it takes a special type of psychological scientist to tell the little old lady sitting next to him on a flight to Denver that he studies how people use their penises when she asks what he does for a living. In any event, if you think there's only one way to use your penis, that it's merely an instrument of internal fertilization that doesn't require further thought, or that size doesn't matter, well, that just goes to show how much you can learn from Gallup's research findings. Gallup's approach to studying the design of the human penis is a perfect example of reverse engineering as it's used in the field of evolutionary psychology. And reverse engineering is an often unspoken concept that you'll find me using repeatedly throughout this book. This is a logico-deductive investigative technique for uncovering the adaptive purpose or function of existing, or what's called extant, physical traits, psychological processes, or cognitive biases. That is to say, if you start with what you see today, in this case, the oddly shaped penis, with its bulbous glands, the head in common parlance, its long, rigid shaft, and the coronal ridge that forms a sort of umbrella lip between these two parts, and work your way backward regarding how it came to look like that, the reverse engineer is able to posit a set of function-based hypotheses derived from evolutionary theory. In the present case, we're talking about penises, but But the logic of reverse engineering can be applied to just about anything organic, from the shape of our incisors, to the opposability of our thumbs, to the arch of our eyebrows. For the evolutionary psychologist, the pressing questions are essentially, why is it like that, and what is that for? The answer isn't always that it's a biological adaptation, that it solves some evolutionary problem and therefore gave our ancestors a competitive edge in terms of their reproductive success. Sometimes a trait is just a byproduct of other adaptations. Blood isn't red, for example, because red worked better than green or yellow or blue, but only because it contains the red hemoglobin protein, which happens to be an excellent transporter of oxygen and carbon dioxide. But in the case of the human penis, all signs point to a genuine adaptive reason that it has come to look the way it does. If you were to examine the penis objectively, please don't do this in a public place or without the other person's permission, and compare the shape of this organ with the design of the same organ in other species, you'd notice the following uniquely human characteristics. First, despite variation in size between individuals, the human penis is especially large compared with that of other primates. When erect, it measures on average between 5 and 6 inches in length and about 5 inches in circumference. Even the most well-endowed chimpanzee, the species that is our closest living relative, doesn't come anywhere near this. Rather, even after correcting for overall mass and body size, chimp penises are about half the size of human penises in both length and circumference. I'm afraid that I'm a more reliable source on this than most. Having spent the first 5 years of my academic life studying great ape social cognition, I've seen more simian penises than I care to mention. I once spent a summer with a 450-pound silverback gorilla that was hung like a wasp. He was a great guy, though. And I babysat a lascivious young orangutan that liked to insert his penis in just about anything with a hole, which unfortunately one day included my ear. In addition, only the human species has such a distinctive mushroom-capped glands, which is connected to the shaft by a thin tissue of frenulum, the delicate tab of skin just beneath the urethra. Chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans have a much less extravagant phallic design, more or less all shaft. It turns out that one of the most significant features of the human penis isn't so much the glands per se, as the coronal ridge it forms underneath. The diameter of the glands where it meets the shaft is wider than the shaft itself. This results in the coronal ridge that runs around the circumference of the shaft, something Gallup, by using the logic of reverse engineering, believed might be an important evolutionary clue to the origins of the strange sight of the human penis. Now, the irony doesn't escape me, but even though this particular evolutionary psychologist, yours truly, is gay, for the purposes of research, we must consider the evolution of the human penis in relation to the human vagina. Magnetic imaging studies of heterosexual couples having sex reveal that during coitus, the typical penis completely expands and occupies the vaginal tract, and with full penetration can even reach the woman's cervix and lift her uterus. This, combined with the fact that human ejaculate is expelled with great force and considerable distance, up to 2 feet if not contained, suggests that men are designed to release sperm into the uppermost portion of the vagina possible. In an article published in the journal Evolutionary Psychology, Gallup and Rebecca Birch argued that a longer penis would not only have been an advantage for leaving semen in a less accessible part of the vagina, but by filling and expanding the vagina, it also would aid and abet the displacement of semen left by other males as a means of maximizing the likelihood of paternity. This semen displacement theory, as they call it, is the most intriguing part of Gallup's story. We may prefer to regard our species as being blissfully monogamous, but at least some degree of fooling around has been our modus operandi for at least as long as we've been on two legs. Since sperm cells can survive in a woman's cervical mucus for up to several days, if she has more than one male sexual partner over this period of time, say within 48 hours, then the sperm of these two men are competing for reproductive access to her ovum. According to Gallup and Birch, examples include group sex, gang rape, promiscuity, prostitution, and resident male insistence on sex in response to suspected infidelity. And although semen displacement is the competing male's goal, even nicely evolved penises aren't perfect. In fact, the authors cite the well-documented cases of human heteroparity, where fraternal twins are in fact sired by two different fathers who had sex with a mother within close succession of each other, as evidence of our species' natural sexual inclinations. So how did natural selection equip men to solve the adaptive problem of other men impregnating their sexual partners? The answer, according to Gallup, is their penises were sculpted in such a way that the organ would effectively displace the semen of competitors from their partner's vagina, a well-synchronized effect facilitated by the upsuck of thrusting during intercourse. Specifically, the coronal ridge offers a special removal service by expunging foreign sperm. According to this analysis, The effect of thrusting would be to draw other men's sperm away from the cervix and back around the glands, thus scooping out the semen deposited by a sexual rival. You might think that's fine and dandy, but one couldn't possibly prove such a thing. You'd be underestimating Gallup, however, who just so happens to be a very talented experimental researcher. Among other things, he's also well known for developing the famous mirror self-recognition test for use with chimpanzees back in the early 1970s. In a series of studies published in Evolution and Human Behavior, Gallup and a team of his students put the semen displacement hypothesis to the test using artificial human genitalia of different shapes and sizes. They even concocted several batches of realistic seminal fluid. Findings from the study may not have proved the semen displacement hypothesis, but they certainly confirmed its principal points. Here's how the basic study design worked. And perhaps I ought to preempt the usual refrain by pointing out that yes, Gallup and his co-authors did receive full ethical approval from their university to conduct this study. The researchers selected several sets of prosthetic genitals from erotic novelty stores, including a realistic latex vagina, sold as a masturbation pal for lonely straight men, and tied off at one end to prevent leakage, and three artificial phalluses. The first latex phallus was 6.1 inches long and 1.3 inches in diameter, with a coronal ridge extending approximately 0.20 inches from the shaft. The second phallus was the same length, but its coronal ridge extended only 0.12 inches from the shaft. Finally, the third phallus matched the other two in length, but lacked a coronal ridge entirely. In other words, whereas the first two phalluses closely resembled an actual human penis, varying only in the coronal ridge properties, the third, what's called the control phallus here, was the bland and headless horseman of the bunch. Next, the researchers borrowed a recipe for simulated semen from another like-minded evolutionary psychologist, Todd Shackelford, and created several batches of seminal fluid. The recipe consisted of 0.08 cups of sifted, white, unbleached flour mixed with 1.06 cups of water. This mixture was brought to a boil, simmered for 15 minutes while being stirred, and allowed to cool. In a controlled series of displacement trials, the vagina was loaded with this fake semen, and the phalluses were inserted at varying depths to simulate thrusting, and removed, whereupon the latex orifice was examined to determine how much semen had been displaced from it. As predicted, the two phalluses with the coronal ridges displaced significantly more semen from the vagina, each removed 91%, than the headless control, which removed only 35.3%. Additionally, the farther the phalluses were inserted, that is to say, the deeper the thrust, the more semen was displaced. When the phallus with the more impressive coronal ridge was inserted 3/4 of the way into the vagina, it removed only a third of the semen, whereas it removed nearly all of the semen when inserted completely. Shallow thrusting, simulated by the researchers inserting the artificial phallus halfway or less into the artificial vagina, failed to displace any semen at all. So if you want advice that'll give you a leg up in the evolutionary arms race, don't go west, young man, go deep. For the second part of the study, Gallup administered a series of survey questions to college-age students about their sexual history. Drawing from previous studies that showed how sexual jealousy inspires predictable and biologically adaptive mate-guarding responses in human males, these questions were meant to determine whether certain penile behavior, which is my term, not theirs, could be expected based on the men's suspicion of infidelity in their partners. In the first of these anonymous questionnaires, heterosexual men and women reported that in the wake of allegations of female cheating, men thrust deeper and faster. Results from a second questionnaire revealed that upon first being sexually reunited after time apart, couples engaged in more vigorous sex. Namely, compared with baseline sexual activity where couples see each other more regularly, vaginal intercourse following periods of separation involved deeper and quicker thrusting. Hopefully, you're thinking as an evolutionary psychologist at this point and can infer what these survey data mean. By using their penises proficiently as a semen displacement device, men are subconsciously, in some cases consciously, combating the possibility that their partners have had sex with another man in their absence. Doubtful about this interpretation? The really beautiful thing about evolutionary psychology, or the most frustrating if you're one of its many critics, is that you don't have to believe it's true for it to work precisely this way. Natural selection doesn't much mind if you favor an alternative explanation for why you get so randy upon being reunited with your partner. Your penis will go about its business of displacing sperm regardless. There are many other related hypotheses that are based on the central logic of the semen displacement theory. In their 2004 evolutionary psychology piece, for example, Gallup and Birch expound on a number of fascinating spin-off ideas in a follow-up article to their earlier work on the natural history of the penis. For example, One obvious criticism of the theory is that men would essentially disadvantage their own reproductive success by removing their own sperm cells from their sexual partner. However, in your own sex life, you've probably noticed what's called the refractory period immediately following ejaculation, during which males almost instantly lose their tumescence, which means their erection deflates to half its full size within 1 minute of ejaculating. Their penises become rather hypersensitive, and further thrusting even turns somewhat unpleasant. In fact, for anywhere between 30 minutes and 24 hours, most men are rendered temporarily impotent following ejaculation. According to Gallup and Birch, these post-ejaculatory features, in addition to the common sedation effect of orgasm, may be adaptations to the problem of self-semen displacement, meaning that the odds of removing your own sperm are reduced considerably when your penis is sore or flaccid or while you're soundly asleep. Gallup and Birch also leave us with a very intriguing hypothetical question in their article. Is it possible, short of artificial insemination, they ask, for a woman to become pregnant by a man she never had sex with? We think the answer is yes. It's a tricky one to wrap your head around, but basically Gallup and Birch say that semen displacement theory predicts that something like the following example would be possible. And note that I've modified this from the original article for your listening pleasure. Also, observe how the scenario is especially relevant to uncircumcised men. If Josh were to have sex with Kate, who recently had sex with Mike, in the process of Josh's thrusting his penis back and forth in her vagina, some of Mike's semen would be forced under Josh's frenulum, would collect behind his coronal ridge, and would be displaced from the area proximate to the cervix. After Josh ejaculates and substitutes his semen for that of the other male, as he withdraws from the vagina, some of Mike's semen will still be present on the shaft of his penis and behind his coronal ridge. As his erection subsides, the glands will withdraw under the foreskin, raising the possibility that some of Mike's semen could be captured underneath the foreskin and behind the coronal ridge in the process. Were Josh to then have sex with Amy several hours later, it's possible that some of the displaced semen from Mike would still be present under his foreskin and thus may be unwittingly transmitted to Amy, who, in turn, could then be impregnated by Mike's sperm. It's not exactly an immaculate conception, but just imagine the gasp from your average Maury Povich show audience. People have some pretty strong feelings about penises. Initial reactions to the essay you've just heard ranged from the incredulous, "Are you seriously suggesting that chimpanzees aren't promiscuous?" to the imaginative, "Penises, they're so cute, you just want to pinch their cheeks and give them cookies." To the rather irritable, stupid, biased thinking again from an evolutionary psychologist. So I decided to speak directly with Gordon Gallup, whose controversial semen displacement theory, after all, was the one that struck up such a brouhaha regarding the adaptive functioning of this enigmatic organ. Perhaps, I appealed to him, he might offer us a few more clarifying details regarding the theory. I took many of the core questions to heart and asked Gordon to respond by email to several of them. Readers wrote, "The latex genitalia study wasn't terribly convincing because the models were circumcised, and in real life the foreskin would interfere with the semen-displacing functions of the coronal ridge. So, does the foreskin pose a problem for the semen-displacement theory?" "The length of the foreskin," said Gallup, "is one of the most variable features of the human penis. When most uncircumcised males achieve an erection, it pulls the foreskin back over the glands and back down the shaft of the penis, enabling the coronal ridge to do its business and scoop rival male semen away from the woman's cervix. Because circumcision reduces the diameter of the shaft immediately behind the glands and accentuates the coronal ridge, we've speculated that the practice of circumcision may have unwittingly modified the penis in ways that enable it to function as a more effective semen displacement device." Armchair speculation? "No," says Gallup. "The idea could be tested by comparing the incidence of non-paternity between circumcised and intact males. Gallup's prediction would be that circumcised males ought to experience a lower incidence of being cuckolded." "So why did human penises evolve to have foreskin at all then?" asked readers. "Evolution does not occur by design," says Gallup. "The best way to think about most adaptations is in terms of cost-benefit ratios. I suspect that the foreskin provided protection of the glands, and what you see is the result of a statistical compromise of sorts." Readers respond, "If the penis really evolved to displace semen, then why wouldn't other promiscuous primate species, namely chimpanzees, have evolved similarly designed penises with a coronal ridge?" "Again," says Gallup, "evolution doesn't occur by design. It occurs by selection, and the raw material for such selection consists of nothing more than random genetic accidents, what are called mutations. embedded in the evolutionary history of human genital design were some penis-shaped mutations, not present in other species, that led to a device that could be used to compete with other males for paternity. Other promiscuous primates, such as chimpanzees, have solved the problem through sperm competition. Male chimpanzees have testicles that are 3 times the size of humans, and differences in sperm count are on the same order of magnitude. Chimpanzees compete among one another for paternity by leaving the largest and most potent volume of semen in the female reproductive tract. When it comes to selection based on genetic accidents, there are a number of ways to skin the adaptive cat, says Gallup. And speaking of cats and penises, it's perhaps useful to reflect in closing on cat penises. Like human males, male cats possess remarkably specialized penises. They come equipped with a band of about 150 sharp, backward-pointing spines that literally rake the internal walls of the female cat's vagina, hence the deafening yowl that often accompanies feline sex. This both triggers ovulation and displaces the sperm of prior males that may have recently mounted her. We should give thanks, and I say this as a gay man, and one not without some stakes in this whole painful affair, that evolution took a somewhat gentler course in our species. Not so fast. What's so premature about premature ejaculation? It occurred to me recently, under conditions that I leave to your ample and likely sordid imagination, how dare you, that the very concept of premature ejaculation in human males is a strange one, at least from an evolutionary theoretical perspective. After all, the function of ejaculation isn't really a mysterious biological occurrence. It's an evolved mechanism designed by nature to launch semen, and therefore sperm cells, as far into the dark, labyrinthine abyss of the female reproductive tract as possible. And once one of these skyrocketed male gametes, in a vigorous race against millions of other single-task cells, finds and penetrates a fertile ovum, and miracle of miracles, successful conception occurs, well then, natural selection can congratulate itself on a job well done. So given these basic biological facts, and assuming that ejaculation is not so premature that it occurs prior to intromission, and sperm cells find themselves awkwardly outside of a woman's reproductive tract flopping about like fish out of water, what exactly is so premature about premature ejaculation? In fact, all else being equal, in the ancestral past, wouldn't there likely